I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The most recent book from the Dutch journalist and historian Rutger Bregman is Utopia for Realists, How We Can Build the Ideal World. He joined me last week while in town to speak at TED 2017. The book is revolutionary in how it calls for a universal basic income, a 15-hour work week, and open borders. It is the author's contention that these ideas, if put in place, would see us achieve utopia. I'll get Mr. Bregman, who joins me now, to explore his book and the world he would like to see. He makes a compelling case that it's not unthinkable and that it is possible, considering what's happened in the last 100 years plus, women's suffrage and universal marriage, not to mention the abolition of slavery. Rutger Bregman is a journalist at The Correspondent. He's published 4 previous books that have been acclaimed and best-selling. The Twitter handle is at RC Bregman. This new book is published by Little Brown. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Rutger Bregman. Mr. Bregman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess I should wish you a happy birthday, because while you were in town last week, you celebrated a birthday.
Yeah, that's true.
I guess there are worse places to celebrate a birthday than Vancouver. I always wonder what people from out of town think of here.
It's an incredibly beautiful place. I mean, I'm from the Netherlands, which is like the flattest part of the earth.
Uh-huh.
So I just can't stop staring at the mountains.
Over the years, I guess people ask you this, is why you stay in the Netherlands, especially since you have the opportunity to live anywhere you want, I'm assuming. Is that utopia for you?
The Netherlands?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I published this book in 2014 for a Dutch audience, and so a lot of ideas in the book about basic income, borders, 15-hour work week are very relevant to the Netherlands as well. So no, I'm afraid we're not living in utopia just yet. But I must admit, when it comes to urban planning,
mm-hmm.
you know, with all our bicycles, I think that's pretty much or should be the future of any city. Get rid of the cars and let the bicycles come in.
Yeah. Well, we have that in Vancouver. I guess you've seen what we've done here. I guess we're trying to do the same here, right?
Yeah, but it's not radical enough.
Yeah.
Just get rid of all the cars.
How was your TED talk here in Vancouver this past week? How was that received?
Well, it was an amazing experience. I mean, you must understand, I've been preparing this since last November, so it was the most exciting thing I probably ever did. And it went really well, actually. They liked my jokes, and they even gave me a standing ovation at the end of it. So, yeah, I was really relieved afterwards.
Yeah, and are you finding it through your travels that you're getting a warm reception, not only for yourself, of course, but for the ideas that are in this book, Utopia for Realists?
Well, basic income is an idea that's really conquering the globe right now. You know, when I first wrote about it in 2013, it was a completely obscure subject at the fringes of the debate, and now it's everywhere. I mean, actually, Canada is at the forefront of the debate with a very exciting experiment that's going to start in Ontario.
Yeah, I guess for a lot of people, when they think of basic income, they think of welfare, and you're very clear in the book that there is a distinction between the two, right?
Exactly. So welfare is incredibly conditional nowadays. You know, there are so many forms you have to fill in and things that you have to apply for and so many government care workers that are looking over your shoulder, etc., etc. And the main characteristic of a basic income is that it's unconditional. So, yeah, it's just about giving people the means to get up and decide for themselves what they want to do with their lives. I really like to see it as venture capital for the people.
Yeah, and what have you found in terms of where this has happened and how people have reacted when given money to live on?
Yeah.
I mean, we assume that they'll go on a spending spree or that the price of everything will go up. I mean, is that the case?
Yeah. Well, the most important objection, obviously, to basic income is that many people have is that they worry that other people, not themselves obviously, but other people will stop working and be lazy and spend it all on drugs, alcohol, or Netflix, or whatever. And what I always say is, well, let's just look at the evidence. Let's see what happens. And we've got quite a lot of evidence already. One of the most fascinating experiments actually happened in a small town called Dauphin near Manitoba in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
There was in the 70s. experiment lasted for 4 years. Poverty was completely eradicated in that town. And after 4 years, you know, there was a new government, and they said, well, what kind of crazy experiment is this? You're actually giving free money to people? Stop this at once. And, you know, there was no money left to analyze the results. It was only 25 years later that a professor, Evelyn Forget, found the records, did the analysis, and discovered that it had been an incredible success. So healthcare costs went down, kids performed much better in school, domestic violence incidents were down, mental health improved, etc., etc. So this is just one of the stories that I tell in my book.
Yeah, and the other story that you tell in the book is Richard Nixon's own plan to do the same, yeah, in the United States, and he came very close, didn't he?
He almost did it. He almost did it. His plan for a modest basic income got through the House twice, mm-hmm, and it hit the Senate floor, and there it was basically killed by the left because the Democrats wanted the higher basic income. It's a history full of ironies. At the end of the 60s, almost everyone, from the left to the right, you know, Galbraith, the economist, but also Milton Friedman, the right-wing economist, they all believed that some form of basic income was going to be implemented in the near future. And there's not a big reason, actually, why it didn't happen, just a lot of bizarre coincidences.
So the three tenets that you talk about in the book, the basic income, the 15-hour work week, and open borders, do we need all three for utopia, or can we just have one, say, on its own? And for utopia to really work, as you contend, mm-hmm, in the book, do we need all three?
Well, I think that utopia is a place that you're always striving for. You never really arrive there. So there's this great quote from Oscar Wilde who said that progress is the realization of utopia. But as soon as you arrive in utopia, you look out again and set sail again and think about anew. I mean, every milestone of civilization, the end of slavery, democracy, equal rights for men and women, you know, these were all utopian fantasies once. I think the problem nowadays is that we don't have these new grand visions anymore. You know, when we think about the future, we mainly think about technology or economic growth or the next iPhone or something like that. We don't have very ambitious visions anymore. So the ideas in my book are just examples of, yeah, big visions that we could strive for in the book. But I really think it's important to have utopias in the plural. You know, they should be the lifeblood of democracy.
What are the hindrances to getting to utopia? The hindrances for big visions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess lack of political will is one. But don't you think the systems that we have, capitalism, for example, don't you think that stands, mm-hmm, in the way of all of this?
Well, actually, you could see a basic income as the crowning achievement of capitalism. It would be the crowning achievement of capitalism. I see it as a dividend of progress. You know, because our forefathers worked so hard, we can now afford to give everyone a share of their accomplishments, you know, all the technology, all these institutions that we inherited from them. Some people call it a basic income. There's one Belgian philosopher who calls it the capitalist road to communism. I've always liked that phrase.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's necessarily anti-capitalistic. In the sense, it's just a flaw in the income distribution. It's not the same as communism or anything. It's not that everyone will earn the same amount of money. It's just that everyone will have the means to decide for themselves what to do with their lives, be creative, be entrepreneurial, start a new business, you name it. That's what capitalism is all about, right? Yeah. The opportunity to take risks. And nowadays, there are a lot of people with a lot of great ideas and a lot of energy that just don't have that opportunity. So actually, I think that, universal basic income has the potential to make our current capitalist economy even much more dynamic.
You write in the book about the idea of open borders as a way to reduce inequality in the world. If you open up the border, say, won't you have people flocking to certain places? And I'm thinking of the urban centers. And obviously tensions would arise just with overcrowding, let alone, you know, other issues that might come up. And don't you think that would just encourage more inequality, say?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I'm a historian. And if you zoom out a little bit, then it's then it's pretty obvious that immigration is one of the most important drivers of prosperity in world history. You know, just look at the Roman Empire, the United States, like all the great nations and empires have been founded on the strength of immigrants. I think that the problem nowadays is that we are pretty unsure of who we are and what we want, and this is especially the case in the U.S. But if you have a strong identity, if you know who you are, know where you want to go, you'll also be open to others. I mean, this is true for people in their personal lives, but it's also true on the level of nations. So if you look, for example, at what Germany did in 2015 with the refugee crisis, they said, well, or Angela Merkel, the chancellor, said, wir schaffen das. We can do this. And what was so fascinating to me about that statement was it was patriotic. It was nationalistic. She was basically saying, Germany is great, so we can do this. We can handle this. And we should be proud of it. I really think that we need that kind of narrative around immigration. And sure, there will always be problems. But in the long run, if you weigh all the economic evidence, to me, it's pretty obvious that the benefits far outweigh the cost.
It's a very interesting case you make in the book about how open borders would make a country more nationalistic and raise that sort of conscious pride that one would have for their own country as you're letting people in.
Yeah, it's just the kind of nationalism. I think, you know, the problem with the progressives and the modern left nowadays is that they only know what they're against. So they're basically against everything, against the establishment, against homophobia, against austerity, against nationalism, against growth, etc., etc., etc. What I think is that you also need to know where you are actually for. Mm. And you need to take all those words like freedom, efficiency, innovation, growth, patriotism, etc., redefine them and use them for your own purposes. And that's what's sorely lacking right now these days, especially on the left.
And I guess that's why the far right and Trump, that's why they do so well, is they know how to use the language to their advantage.
Exactly.
where the left doesn't, right?
Exactly. Donald Trump is probably the greatest utopian thinker of our time. He really understands how politics works. What he understands is that if you want to change the world, you need to push at the fringes, you know? There's this concept that I write about at the end of my book called the Overton window. And Robert Overton was a political scientist in the 90s. And he asked the question, how can crazy ideas become thinkable? How can they become reality? And what he said is that there's basically a window. We call it the Overton window right now. And at the center of the window are all the opinions that are seen as acceptable by the establishment and mainstream politicians and journalists. But the task of any intellectual or of any activist or whoever wants to really change the world is to move that window. And how do you move that window of what is seen as acceptable? Well, you do it at pushing at the margins, at the fringes of the debate. That's what you need to do. And, you know, just 2 years ago, Donald Trump was saying things and we thought it was all outrageous, but we're already getting used to it. And that's how it works. So it's the same with basic income. When I first wrote about it 4 or 5 years ago, many people thought that I had completely lost my mind. Well, the conversation is pretty different right now.
Yeah, and I guess when we see sort of left-wing parties, we saw this recently in the federal election in this country, move to the center or even to the right.
Exactly.
They never gain what they intend to gain because they alienate their base.
And this is what I call underdog socialism. So what they always do is not rely on their own ideas, values, and visions, but, sort of always move in the direction that the opponents are also moving. It's a tragedy.
Yeah. Well, so do you think the open borders concept that you propose in your book, Utopia for Realists, can happen, especially with Trump wanting to build walls or Geert Wilders in your country, Le Pen in France? I mean, I just don't see how this happens today.
I obviously understand that open borders is the most radical idea in my book. But what I also see happening, and this happens, for example, as I said, in Germany, but also in the Netherlands, there is a huge part of the population that is open to a different kind of language, a different kind of way of talking about these issues. But the thing is that there are very few people left who have the courage to make that case, you know, to really make the case for openness, to really make the case for tolerance, for, you know, how immigrants can make a society a stronger place. I think that's important, that we will have more people to find that courage. Actually, your political leader, Justin Trudeau, is probably one of the few people left, who's, along with Angela Merkel, who still has that courage. But you obviously know much more about that than I do.
What do you think needs to happen in terms of how we think about making great change? And I mean, we always wonder when the right time is. Mm-hmm. And I guess, is it a time of crisis that this stuff needs to happen?
Yeah, I do think that crises play an incredibly important role in history. So if you just look at the history of the 20th century, you have the Great Depression, and the Great Depression enabled John Maynard Keynes, you know, to launch his ideas. Then you had, in the 70s, you had stagflation and the oil crises, and this paved the way for Milton Friedman, Friedrich von Hayek, and neoliberalism. The problem in 2008 with the financial crash was that the homework had not been done, you know. There were no new ideas. The crisis was there, so the opportunity was there, but then there were no new ideas, and we had the Occupy movement that famously had no program at all. So what I just hope is that 2016 was quite obviously another year of crisis, you know, uh-huh. with Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. What I hope is that, we'll do better this time around. And there are some signs of hope. As I said, a lot of people are interested in an idea like basic income. So we're a little bit better prepared right now, but we'll have to see about what happens.
Yeah, I guess the most recent example of a crisis where, and you write about this in the book, where it could have been done was the economic crisis of 2008.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that should have been like the big turning point. But the problem was that, again, the progressives and the left had moved so far towards the right and had basically said to each other, well, history has ended. You know, you probably remember that famous book by Francis Fukuyama, the philosopher, mm-hmm. yeah. about the end of history and the last man. And this was an idea that was, very popular, that we didn't need these utopian visions anymore. You know, I was born in 1988, a year before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And when I went to school and to university, this was the story that I was told over and over again, that we had basically arrived at the end of history, at the end of big politics, etc., and that all we had to worry about is, I don't know, the climate and how we could jumpstart the economy and those kind of things. Yeah. But not like really the big questions about how we want to live, how we want to change our society. Those questions weren't being asked anymore. And then suddenly the crisis came and everyone was like, what? and there were no answers.
The idea of the 15-hour work week, I mean, it appeals to a lot of people because they think that they'd have a lot of free time to do nothing. But you write in the book about how the work we're doing, whether it's 40 hours a week or more, is just not effective. And yeah. We're not as productive as we can be.
Yeah. What I think we should do is to spend less time in jobs that we don't care about, and do more real work, and often that will be unpaid work. So there's an incredible amount of volunteers work, caring for our kids, caring for our elderly, that's not included in GDP, but it's really, really important. You know, just imagine if all the volunteers would go on strike in Canada. That will probably be a disaster.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of paid work that's really important as well. In the book I've got the example of the garbage men that go on strike. Well, complete disaster as well. But then there are also a lot of jobs, and many of them well paid, and these jobs are often done by people with excellent resumes, very smart people, but at the end of the day, they'll admit to you that their job is completely useless.
Yeah.
You know, just 2 years ago, there was a poll in the UK that found out that 37% of British workers have a job that they think don't even need to exist. So a very easy way to find out if you have one of those jobs is just go on strike and see what happens. In the book, I've got one story of the only strike that I could find in all of world history of bankers. It happened only once in all world history, and that was Ireland 1970. The strike lasted for 6 months, and nothing much happened. So the economy just kept growing, and after 6 months, they went back to work and said, all right. And I think that just shows you that we really need to rethink what work even is, you know. Yeah. I'm not saying we should move towards a 15-hour work week to sit on the couch or, again, watch Netflix or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that we actually need to work less in order to do more.
What are, I mean, you call them bullshit jobs in the book. What are, I mean, what sector would we find most of them in?
Finance, definitely.
Yeah.
So a huge part of the modern finance sector is completely useless. And that's not just me saying it. It's the International Monetary Fund as well, the Bank of International Settlements, not exactly left-wing think tanks. But we've got a lot of evidence that when a financial sector becomes bigger than 100% of GDP in terms of private debt, it actually starts destroying wealth. You know, then it becomes rent-seeking. So a huge part of the modern financial sector is basically about living on the wealth of other people. About freeloading. Those are the modern rentiers, you know, the aristocrats of today. And again, this is not a controversial statement. This is not some leftist statement. This is being said by neoliberal economists right now. So, if you'd ask many of these people, give them one beer or maybe two beers, at the end of the day, they'll admit to you, well, my job doesn't have anything of value. Just think of, for example, flash trading.
Yeah.
Buying shares and selling them a few milliseconds after that, it's completely useless. Doesn't add any social value, but it can earn you a lot of money. So, yeah, that's basically free riding. That's sort of an economic parasite. Those kind of jobs are completely useless.
And so through all of this, I mean, you remain an optimist, don't you?
Well, I like to see myself as a possibilist.
Mm.
So... optimists, I always get the feeling that their point is, I mean, the Silicon Valley type optimist basically says, well, just sit back, enjoy the ride, technology will solve all our problems. And I don't think that's the case. I think that a different world is possible, but we'll have to get up and do something, you know? And I really like to emphasize that real change doesn't start in places like, I don't know, Washington or Westminster or The Hague or other political capitals of the world. It so often starts just with regular people talking to each other about new ideas. You know, just this morning, I had a fascinating conversation with a Canadian woman and a Dutch guy that he read my book a few years ago about, and there was one example in the book about where in London they gave unconditional cash transfer to homeless people, which turned out to be incredibly effective. You know, they gave £3,000, and at the end of the year, 7 out of 13 of the men had a roof above their head, and they had saved a huge amount of money. And this guy read that chapter and said, "Well, let's just do it." You know, and now they've started what they called the New Leaf Project, and they've already got government funding for it, and they're going to do a real proper scientific study about what unconditional cash transfers can do for homeless people living in Vancouver. Now, that's how real change works. You know, it doesn't start with politicians. It starts with people like this.
Yeah. And so you are seeing places as you travel around the world where we're inching closer to utopia, say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been incredible to see how just 5 years ago, as I said, no one knew about basic income. And now Finland is doing an experiment. Ontario is doing an experiment. In Oakland, Silicon Valley, there's going to be an experiment. Kenya, there's a big experiment has already started. So this idea is really conquering the globe right now. There are a lot of big challenges we are facing right now, from climate change to rising inequality to xenophobia. So, yes, we need to think big in order to address these challenges.
Well, as you travel throughout, I guess you're going down the coast, I guess the west coast in the next few days. Safe travels and continued good luck with this book. It's a terribly engaging book and one that's given me at least a lot to think about. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
The Twitter handle is @RCBregman. The book is called Utopia for Realists: How We Can Build the Ideal World. It's from Little Brown. Its author, Rutger Bregman, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.